This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. You ever heard of that before? We're about to talk about revolutions. We're about to talk about the good one. We're going to get to Kevin Roberts to talk about that in a moment. But we're going to talk about bad ones as well. There have been many of them. People love the idea. Americans love the idea of revolution. But should we? Revolutions can be and often are horrific, barbaric things. So like I just said, we need to be careful what we wish for. Now, let's focus on the good first, though. Let's focus on the American Revolution. Revolutions sound good, but why do we like the sound of revolution as Americans? Because we had the one that worked out. So when we think about American Revolution, we think about freedom, getting rid of a tyrant. Most of them don't work out, but we won God's lottery, and ours worked out quite well. Let's talk about that with the president of the Great Heritage Foundation. I don't know what the heck we'd have done without Heritage over the past several decades. Dr. Kevin Roberts joins us now. Okay, Kevin, could you please, before we dig into the American Revolution, tell people, because most don't know, especially because our education system sucks, what was America like before the Revolution, the Seven Years' War? What did that have to do with anything?
Well, the Seven Years' War was vital because it actually trained up the colonial militia into almost a regular army, and that obviously had a direct military impact on the revolution. But even more important than the military, Jesse, was what the American people were like. And ultimately, they were had an emerging American identity. They had an identity that was becoming very different from the British identity. It's a way of saying that we're very fond in the United States of claiming that we're a classless society. That's largely true. It's particularly true in the mid-1700s in contrast to Britain, which, of course, was a heavily infatuated with class. All of that to say, America was a middle-class place. You could earn a good living. If you were free, obviously there were slaves, and the United States fixed that eventually. But if you were a free person and you worked hard, you could get ahead in every colony and every city in every colony. And that was very different than Britain. And so it was primed to be in a successful revolution against the British Empire.
The Seven Years' War also really depleted the British Empire in many ways, them pulling back from the wilderness, leaving our people naked out there, didn't it?
Well, it did. And what happened was the performance of the British Army in the Seven Years' War showed the Americans that they actually couldn't depend on the British military to defend them. This was especially true on the western side of the colonies, roughly speaking, the Appalachian region from Pennsylvania all the way down to North Georgia, as you know. Colonists there had direct interaction, not just with the British Army, but also with regional Indian tribes, most of whom got the better of the British, along occasionally with some of the French. So even though the British prevailed in the Seven Years' War, the experience for the colonists, including George Washington, who cut his teeth as a young military colonel in that war, as you know, was very negative. And it proved to them that not only could the British be counted on, but a decade later, when we decided that we would declare independence from Britain, it actually gave colonists more confidence than you might think they would have possessed otherwise.
No doubt. What was the Stamp Act, and why were they so mad about that whole thing? Why can't you pay a little bit more for a stamp? What's the big deal?
Yeah, the Stamp Act was a really fancy tax. And so basically, although unfortunately we've gotten accustomed to this kind of thing in the modern United States, any sheet of paper that you had basically had to be notarized. That's the best way of understanding it in our modern vocabulary. And in order to get that stamp from the colonial or government official, you had to pay a few pence. You had to pay a little bit of money. And between paying the money, but also just the inconvenience of time, but I would argue even more importantly than those two things, just the ever presence of a British government official intruding on every aspect of your life, colonists had enough. And so they started the Stamp Act Congress, which was a precursor to our own Congress. The Stamp Act Congress not only was important in some of the policies that it articulated, but it also helped galvanize this this really healthy rebelliousness by the American colonists. Most importantly, Jesse, I would argue, it actually gave Americans, these colonists, sort of cultural icons, a flag, certain songs, certain poems that came out of the Stamp Act. This is really important because for the first time in an organized way, it gave Americans a sense that they really did have their own identity that was separate from the British. We underestimate the importance of that because it's kind of vague. It's, you know, it's intangible. But that sense of a shared identity across the 13 colonies was vital to the ultimate success of the American Revolution. It wouldn't happen without the Stamp Act.
Speaking of success, I mean, let's fast forward through a couple things. Obviously, the United States of America became an incredible success after we gained our independence. As I said in the opening, though, that is not the norm. Kevin, as you obviously know, revolutions are generally disasters. Almost every time they're disasters. It's not hard to get people angry about the regime in power and toss them out. It's very difficult to land with something decent on the other side of that. But we did. Why?
Well, I think that's one of the most fascinating questions, not just in American history, but in all of world history. And as you know, I've spent a lot of time studying and teaching that over the last couple of decades. Ultimately, I'll focus on three or four. The first was, or is, that the United States in the 1700s was a place that was not divided by class. Obviously, there were a lot of enslaved people, about 20% of the American population. Separate from that huge exception, the United States was a place that was not dictated, it wasn't divided according to socioeconomic status. This is important for the outcome of the revolution because, unlike, say, in France, a decade and a half later, where not only did you have the overthrow of the monarchy, you had the poorer Frenchmen trying to overthrow the landed aristocracy. In the United States, you didn't have that pent-up frustration. And so, ultimately, when you get on the back end, the successful conclusion of the American Revolution, there isn't a desire to reorder society. In fact, there is a desire to continue something, ironically, that the British taught the Americans, which was that you wanted to have both liberty and order, something that Washington called ordered liberty. You wanted to be a free person. But you also understood that there were certain conventions in society. There were certain customs. You had a moral obligation to help other people be free. That was a distinctly American idea that was utterly lacking in France, where freedom came to be defined as your freedom to do whatever the heck you wanted to do. In the United States, it was much more ordered, dare I say, more virtuous. And then the last reason, I think, is that the United States was a place because even though it was much smaller when the American Revolution was concluded than it is today, that geographically you could move around, you could actually experience your freedom physically, geographically. And so that really accentuated that lack of motivation that most Americans had to upend society, because if you didn't like your life where you were, for the most part, if you were a free person, you could get up and leave. And that actually propelled the westward expansion that continued all the way until the early 1900s.
Okay, so let's switch gears as we, you know, wrap this whole thing up here. Why are so many other revolutions, why can't they duplicate that? Surely at least some people at the top or a lot of people involved in them, that's what they want on the back end of it, whether you're tossing off a dictator here or there. Surely they want to be free and ordered and good. But it pretty much never works out that way. Why do they fail where we succeeded?
Well, I'm going to write a headline for you that's politically incorrect, because America is an exceptional place. And it's exceptional, meaning that we aren't superior to other people by any stretch. Every human's equal in the eyes of God, obviously. But we have some exceptional qualities about actually wanting to have an orderly transition of power that comes ironically from the political philosophy we inherited from the British. But if you think about the other revolutions that have happened since, you think about the French Revolution in close proximity to the American Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, and then a lot of revolutions in the mid-20th century, mostly from African and Latin American countries throwing off the yoke of communism. Many of those countries continue to struggle with that because they have inherited this disease of Marxism. The institutions that the communist, for example, took over in those countries, this is a really important lesson for us in the 21st century of the United States, actually miseducated their people. They miseducated them so that they didn't understand not just how to be free, but they also miseducated them in understanding that order, that sort of government power, came from on high, not just a king in the case of the 1700s, but in the case of the communists from the Politburo. But instead, we understand in the United States, sovereignty comes from the individual. It comes from nature, or it comes from God. And that is a really underappreciated aspect of why most other revolutions fail. We ought to feel very blessed in the United States to have had such a successful revolution that has persisted in its ideals and well until the 21st century.
Yeah, we should have. Doctor, thank you so much. Love you guys at Heritage. We'll break bread soon. All right. That's ours. I hope that put a smile on your face. It blessed me. We are so blessed. But as we mentioned, there are a lot of them that they didn't go well. Pretty much all of them. It's most of them. It's 99% of them. I made up that number, but it's a lot. Let's talk about some that didn't go well. Next. All right, so that was the American Revolution. That was the good one. But as I've explained, most of them aren't good. We have a really fluffy, shiny view of revolution here in America because ours turned out well, but most revolutions are ugly, feminist ugly. Speaking of which, joining me now, my friend Jack Posobiec. I should use other titles, but I'm going to be forced to call him author Jack Posobiec today because he wrote this great book, Unhuman. You should really read it. But Jack, before we get to your book, let's talk about one of the subjects in that book, the French Revolution. Now, I am an American, therefore I don't care about the French, but this is a really, really revealing event in human history. Tell us about it.
Well, unfortunately for all of us, Jesse, even though we are not French, we are still living through the effects of the French Revolution and its consequences, because, of course, the French Revolution is the predicate revolution that then kicks off the Russian Revolution, which leads to the Spanish Revolution, which leads to the Chinese Communist Revolution, and so many more around the world. The French Revolution, when it's kicked off early on, it actually starts out so quietly because it's all about bringing together Parliament. At the time, they called it the Estates General. And the king decides, King Louis says, we're going to put together the Parliament because we need to raise some taxes. And I've decided that I've given the Parliament this authority. I don't have this authority anymore. So we're going to call the Estates General back in and we're going to raise taxes. Well, the Estates General opens up and they says, you know, we need to do more than raise taxes. We need some equality around here. And we need some equal protections and equal rights and equal justice. And we need inclusion. That's what we need. And it, you know, you're starting to get the sense of this. And they decide that they want to do more than just raise taxes. They say, you know what? We need to right some of the wrongs in French society. In fact, one of those big wrongs in French society, why do we even have these things like kings and leaders and rich people and successful people and priests and religion? And why don't we instead put the most brutal, disgusting, ruthless, ugly, and I'm not just talking about the feminists, but also these trollish little creatures like Maximilien Robespierre, put them in charge and have them start executing everyone who stands in our way, up to and including the king and the queen of France itself. This is constituted in what we call the Reign of Terror, which doesn't end for an entire year of heads piling up in the center of Paris until Robespierre orders and even carries out the execution of a cloister of nuns from Compiègne, where he pulls them down and says, you must swear allegiance to the cult of reason, and how dare you stand up for God and stand up for your beliefs. He starts executing nuns in the center of Paris. This is how bad these things get. And finally, Robespierre is executed himself. And people say, okay, I think this is going a little bit too far. And all of that, of course, leads to something we call the rise of Emperor Napoleon, who comes in. But that, of course, is another story.
Jack, can you explain why the people themselves in the beginning, why would they sign on for such a thing? Because it was, you know, fairly popular enough that it got going. Why wouldn't the people sign on for something so evil?
So, Jesse, and here's the funny part about this, and a lot of people don't even understand this, is that even the king signed on to this. Because the king said, you know, I don't want to seem intolerant. I don't want to seem like I'm politically incorrect. I don't want to seem like I'm not listening to the grievances of the people. So, of course, the king goes along with it. And the king says, well, yeah, we've got to listen. We've got, these are some great ideas that these guys have about all the things that we can do to make France better. We're just going to, you know, it's really just about inclusion. It's really about diversity. It's really about equity and equality. Fraternity, of course, is what they refer to it at the time. And, oh, letting the political prisoners go from the Bastille. Yeah, sure, we're going to do all of that. We're going to do all these things. Don't lock these people up. No, actually treat them in good faith and give them power. Don't summarily round them up and execute them. We're going to go along with all of it. And it's the same type of behavior you see from the House Republicans today that you see from so many elected Republicans that say, guys, let's just work together. Let's find a compromise. Look, they want to execute everyone. So we're going to find them in a compromise. It's really nice. We're going to only going to let them execute half of the people and the other half are going to go to jail. See, you see, it's much better this way. And Jesse, it's this idea of, and I see it on the right today, and you can see it on, and now at the time would have been the monarchists back then, or the traditionalists, the Ancien Régime in France. It's are you addicted to rules? And are you addicted to principles and you don't care anything about power versus people who have no principles whatsoever and yet are addicted to power? Like, we say follow the money in politics a lot or in investigations. What these guys do is they follow the power, and the power will flow to the most brutal, the most repressive, the most ruthless members of the revolutionaries. And this, of course, was the Jacobin Club. So if you have no principles, just like the response we're seeing to the Supreme Court right now, then they view that as a free license to go and kill whoever they want. And when I say they're going mask off, I say it's not mask off. They're always like this. They've been like this for 250 years. And for some reason, people on our side don't seem to get it.
Why don't we get it, Jack? Is it that we don't want to get it, or are we just cowards?
I think it's a little of both. I do think it's a little of both. And I also think that there's a bit of a martyrdom fetish, I think, that exists on the right. I think it comes from this idea that, you know, if I'm going to go to be, you know, to be shot in the head or executed for my beliefs, then that will show that I'm the better person. And that will show that I am actually the more principled person. You're going to out-principle your enemies. Well, guess what, boys and girls? They don't care about your principles. And I hope that your principles matter a lot while your children are being shot in the street in front of you, like was done with the Bolsheviks. I hope that your principles matter a lot to you when your wife is being ravaged in front of you, like happened in Spain, when the nuns and priests are being killed and raped on the altars. I hope that your principles work out really well, but don't worry, because we're more principled than them. And it's this terrifying, and this is where the cowardice part comes in, because they claim it's martyrdom. They claim, and the first layer of it is the martyrdom fetish. But the second layer is ultimately cowardice. The second layer is cowardice because if I claim I want to be a martyr, then that means, oh, I don't have to do anything. I don't actually have to do any work. I don't actually have to go around and text message my friends, or who cares about the fact that the local library is putting queer and LGBT and DEI and anti-racist baby everywhere in their town. Because guess what? The leftists don't think about this. The leftists look at your library and they say, oh, this is a place where I can push my beliefs. So they will take over your library. And this is every library in America. And you can see the table when you first walk in. That's what you'll see. Then the leftist says, oh, I can go and take over the Parks Department. Why the Parks Department? Because I want my gay pride and my trans and my drag parades, and now I'm going to be hosting those in the local playground. And because everybody else around them is going to say, oh, I don't want to rock the boat, or I don't want to stand up and do anything about this, you don't fight back, and eventually those people will win and run roughshod over you because they are short-circuiting this issue that exists in Western civilization, this idea that we should treat everyone fairly. Treat everyone fairly. Well, here's what I say, Jesse. I think that we should treat people the way that they treat us. And I think that we should treat them exactly the way that they treat us. And if the code of Hammurabi, an eye for an eye, is a little bit too much for people, then I'm sorry, you may not be cut out for what needs to be done.
Jack, how did a revolution in France lead to these other revolutions, as you said, Russia, Spanish? How could one lead to the other? Why does that happen?
So it happens because you get the Communist Manifesto. It gets written a couple of decades later after the French Revolution. It takes all these ideas up that we are ruled by this system of evil capitalism, and we are ruled by these horrifically evil monarchs who need to be taken out, who need to be killed, who need to be destroyed. And by the way, this starts happening all across Europe. They start assassinating kings. They start assassinating queens. The Tsar of Russia, Tsar Alexander, gets killed by a hand grenade. Oh, and by the way, you would think nothing like that could ever happen here. The United States, thank goodness, would never. Oh, wait, but in 1901, actually, just a couple decades after the Communist Revolution comes out, an anarcho-socialist walks up to President McKinley and shoots and kills him. And this is how we get Teddy Roosevelt as our youngest president. He was VP at the time. No one even gets taught that one of these anarcho-socialist assassins kills a president of the United States during this period. We just get told, oh, that was just the first Red Scare, and that's a bunch of these red-baiting politicians like Joseph McCarthy want to talk about the kind of stuff. Well, really? Because they killed one of our presidents. So, you know, fast-forwarding or go back a little bit now to Europe. Remember, that happened. So the assassination of McKinley takes place even before the Bolshevik Revolution, because you get this idea, and a lot of this is predicated on the Industrial Revolution, and the elites get so much power, the elites just lord it over people, and then you get the unhuman class. And the unhuman class walks around and says, you see how you're living in squalor, and you see how all those people are doing better than you? Well, instead of working with them and trying to come up with some kind of reform and trying to, I don't know, maybe do something to make things a little bit more fair around here, or work on better wages for the workers, let's just go kill them. Let's go kill them. Let's rape their wives. Let's murder their children, rape their children. Who cares? And we'll do so with the justification that we are on the right side. And this is what Karl Marx gives them. And so suddenly you see this with Lenin, because Lenin takes Marxism and adds something, a little piece to it. What he says is, well, the workers don't seem to be doing this on their own, so we need to institute something called the Revolutionary Vanguard. And the Revolutionary Vanguard is Lenin going around to all the freaks, to the creatures, the bug people all around where he can find them in Russia, putting together what's been called a coalition of the fringes, and saying, in order for us to fix Russia, we have to go kill everyone and take all their stuff. And he's able to do so with great effect. And the Romanovs, by the way, early on, as horrific as it turns out for them, they do the same thing where they go along. He said, well, if I just abdicate, then all of this will go away. And if I just, but I'll stay here and, you know, we can work together and we can find a better way forward for Russia, rather than just order the army to crush the revolutionaries outright, crush the Bolsheviks. No, Romanov doesn't order this. And by the way, I'm not saying in any way that he deserved what he got, because eventually what they did was they said, oh, great, you've abdicated. That's wonderful. Now you're under arrest. Now we're going to lock up you and your wife and your children, all Christian, by the way. We're going to cart you out to the middle of the forest in Siberia. And one night, late in the night, we're going to wake you up and we're going to bring you down to the basement and we're going to shoot you and bayonet your children against the wall. That's what happens when you go along with people. That's exactly what happened. Even young little Prince Alexei was bayoneted against the wall and then eventually shot in the head. So again, when you're dealing with people who have no principles whatsoever, when you're dealing with people whose highest calling is repressive warfare, murder, and violence, then it will always end in piles of bullets. Remember, Jesse, and you write the great book on this as well, that the communists, if people say, why do you support communism? How can people still support communism even after it's killed 100 million people? I say, they look at 100 million people as a good start. They want to increase that number because, remember, those were fascists and those were anti-communists and those were people who were against the revolution. Those were right-wing extremists. And so those people are all in the way. Remember, communism is only always ever only one genocide away from total utopia.
That is a fact, my friend. The book is Unhumans. You need to pick up your phone right now and go order it. It's awesome. It really is. It's a freaking awesome book. Jack, my brother, as always, I appreciate you very much. Unhumans, available wherever books are sold. All right. We're not done yet. What about Mao's revolution? Next. Speaking of ugly revolutions, there have been many of them. I'm sure the competition is fierce, but I have a hard time thinking of a more horrific one than Mao's Cultural Revolution. This is one that's not widely taught in American schools, mainly because American schools are full of dirty communists and they don't want you to know about it, but it was a horrible affair. Let's bring in the man who wrote the book on it, Stephen Mosier, author of the book, wonderful book, terrible book, but you know what I mean, The Devil and Communist China. Okay, Stephen, before we get to the Cultural Revolution, can you help us understand why Mao needed one? The commies had had China since 1949. They'd been in power for, what, 17 years? Why did he need a revolution? Why was a revolution necessary? They had a revolution. They won.
Well, this was factional fighting within the Chinese Communist Party. This was an effort by Chairman Mao to recover his power and prestige that he had lost because of 15 years of mismanagement of the Chinese economy. Remember, they took power in 1949, to be sure, and then they persecuted and killed the landlords, so-called. The rich peasants, they prosecuted and persecuted and tortured and killed millions of people who were formerly with the nationalist regime, who had been in the government of that earlier ruler of China. They killed, tortured many, many people who were intellectuals who opposed the communists for various reasons. And then Chairman Mao launched the great proletarian Great Leap Forward in 1957, forcing 600 million villagers into huge people's communes. That ended in an absolute disaster. 45 million people died in the worst famine in human history from 1960 to 1962. It was an unnecessary famine. It was a man-made famine, a Mao-made famine, really, you should say, because it was made by Chairman Mao. And at that point, Chairman Mao's prestige had dropped fairly low within the ranks of the Chinese Communist Party. In fact, his senior premier, the guy who had worked shoulder to shoulder with him for decades, Liu Shaoqi, came to him in 1962 and said, history is going to reveal us as the worst murderers in Chinese history. We've killed 45 million Chinese, let them starve to death. Mao never forgave him for that slight. So the other communist leaders pushed Mao back into the second rank, and the Cultural Revolution was really an effort by Mao to get back in control of all of China. Now, it purports to be something else, right? Because the communists never tell you exactly what they're about. The ostensible purpose for the Cultural Revolution was to destroy traditional Chinese culture, to destroy any connections that Chinese people had with the West. Anyone who had foreign relatives, anyone who could speak a foreign language like English, anyone who was a student of Confucius or Mencius or admired traditional Chinese culture was an enemy. And he mobilized tens of millions of Red Guards throughout the country to attack these supposed enemies. But within those tens of millions of Red Guards, Jesse, he had some special groups. And these special groups, which were run by his wife, Jiang Qing, his fourth wife, by the way, Jiang Qing, were used to target his political enemies within the Chinese Communist Party. And guess what? Liu Shaoqi, the head of government who had criticized Mao, saying, you know, we're going to be remembered as mass murderers because of the people who died during the famine. He was the first to be arrested. And they tortured and killed Liu Shaoqi at Mao's order. And then the next to go was Peng Dehuai. He was a general who'd been a leading general in the civil war in the 1930s and 40s. He actually saved Mao's life a couple of times, General Peng Dehuai did. But he, too, had criticized the Great Leap Forward 10 years before. And he, too, was the target of these special Red Guard groups, which were targeting Mao's political enemies. Peng Dehuai was a tough old bird. They tortured him for years before they were able to kill him, but they finally did. And then there was Premier Zhou Enlai. Now, Zhou Enlai had purported to be loyal to Chairman Mao during the Great Leap Forward, but he too had questioned some of the policies, and that was enough to get him killed by Chairman Mao. Actually, not outright. This was killing without shedding blood, because what happened with Zhou Enlai, the longtime premier, that people will remember because he's the one that Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, met with on the first secret trip to China. So Zhou Enlai had bladder cancer, and the doctors came to Chairman Mao and said, Zhou Enlai, Premier Zhou has bladder cancer. We need to treat it immediately. And Chairman Mao, remembering that Zhou Enlai had once slighted him, said, no, don't treat the cancer. Let it spread. Don't tell Premier Zhou that he has cancer. Let him die. The Cultural Revolution resulted in the deaths of 20 million Chinese, resulted in the deaths of 100 million others. It led to some really terrible things like political cannibalism. Now, there had been cannibalism before in Chinese history during the Great Leap Forward. People were starving to death, and there were credible reports of people eating the dead bodies of neighbors. But in the Cultural Revolution in 1966, 67, and 68, there was political cannibalism, not caused by hunger, but caused by a desire to absolutely humiliate one's enemies in the party, Mao's enemies in the party. And so they would not only torture and kill their political victims, the enemies of Mao, they would actually desecrate their bodies by cutting them open and parting out the pieces to the other Red Guards. Political cannibalism. Now, Mao once famously said, you know, a revolution is not a dinner party. But in the Cultural Revolution, Jesse, it almost became one.
Good grief. Okay, Stephen, obviously I have a million questions I could ask, but can you help me understand why the destruction of so much of China's history? China has an incredible history. It's hard to find a period of time in the known history of the world where China wasn't prominent and doing wonderful things, but you're desecrating Confucius? What? Help me understand why. What was Mao's axe to grind with these things?
Well, Mao was a committed communist. He was determined to burn everything to the ground, to raise traditional Confucian culture to the ground. And out of that complete destruction of the past, he was going to build paradise. You see, it's the fantasy of every communist leader. They're going to create paradise on earth. They're going to create a new socialist man, a new socialist woman. But they have to start from ground zero. They have to start from a blank slate, a tabula rasa. And in order to get that blank slate, Mao wanted to destroy all of Chinese history, all of China's culture, and so he could basically start over. What he did was, he was very, very good at the destruction part. There's no question about that. But he wasn't very good about building anything back after the destruction. But at base, the Cultural Revolution was not just about destroying traditional Chinese culture and creating a new socialist man, a new socialist woman. At the heart of it was this megalomaniac, this bloodthirsty mass murderer, the worst mass murderer in human history, wanted to get back the reins of power, wanted to destroy his enemies and the party. And to a certain extent, the 20 million people who died and the 100 million people who were persecuted, they were just collateral damage to this factional fighting within the Chinese Communist Party. That's the real tragedy of the Cultural Revolution.
Gosh, there's so many bodies, so much suffering. Stephen, I want people to read the book, obviously, and get a lot more detail on this, but can you help me understand Mao? How could a human being, look, it's You can make the argument, and I would make the argument, that he's the most evil human being to ever walk the planet. How does one go from being a farmer's son to being the worst human being to ever walk the earth? How?
Well, I mean, you know, we all face choices in our life, and Mao, as a very young man, decided that, and he wrote this, he wrote, there are other people and things in the world, but they're only there for my use and my pleasure. So from a very early age, he rejected Confucianism. He rejected the silver rule, do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. And he adopted a totally materialistic, totally utilitarian view of other people. There are other people and things in the world, but they're just there for my use and for my pleasure. And so he consciously chose to go down that path. He totally lacked compassion for other people. If you read, you know, about his life, you find that he had absolutely no feeling for anyone else. He may never have loved anyone else in his entire life. The other odd thing about Mao was, and this is very interesting to me as a cultural anthropologist, when he was a small boy, he was actually taken out to a stone god outside the village where he lived by his mother. And he was rebaptized. He was given a new name before this stone god, this stone monolith. And he was called the third son of the monolith. His original name had been Mao Zedong, of course. We all know Mao Zedong. But his mother gave him the name third son of the monolith, or third son of stone. And he very proudly and often referred to himself as the third son of stone. And the man really did have a heart of stone. He was only out for himself from the beginning. And the result was mass carnage, mass butchery in China. Worst mass murder in human history. 100 million people died in purges and famines. We talked about the Great Famine, of course, 45 million. Other 20 million in the Cultural Revolution, other tens of millions in various purges and persecutions. And then there are the 400 million unborn children who died as a result of the one-child policy. Now, the one-child policy didn't begin until after Mao's death in 1980, when I was in China for the first time. But Mao was the intellectual progenitor of the policy. He provided the intellectual foundation of the policy, because way back in 1958, he said, we need a ministry of reproduction, because we're a socialist country, and we should be controlling the birth of babies the same way that we're controlling the production of steel, the production of bicycles. He said, we need to be in control of reproduction. Well, 22 years later in 1980, the Chinese Communist Party acted on that suggestion and put in place the one-child policy. And the other thing you have to say about the whole killing spree that Mao launched is this. The Communist Party of China, as all communist parties do, has to have a target, has to have an enemy. It always has to have an enemy of the state to refocus the righteous anger of the people against the party for its corruption, for its murderous practices, to redirect the righteous anger of the people away from the Communist Party and away from its leaders like Chairman Mao towards another group. And it was originally the landlords, the entrepreneurs, the intellectuals. But then in 1980, for the first time in human history, the enemy of the state, Jesse, became the unborn child. It was the unborn child who was standing in the way of China's greatness. It was the unborn children of China who were standing in the way of China's progress, China's becoming a first world nation, China becoming the dominant power in the world. And on this altar, which kind of in a symbolic way is similar to the old altars in which the Canaanites and the Philistines and the Aztecs practiced human sacrifice, on those altars, 400 million unborn children were sacrificed as enemies of the state. So the total number of people who have died at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party over the 75 years of its misrule is 500 million. Now, I know that's a number people can't wrap their minds around. But every one of those was a living, breathing human being. Every one of those had human dignity and innate human dignity and had their life torn away from them by this system and by this megalomaniac, this paranoid killer who was running it.
Good grief. He is Stephen Mosher. Go buy his book. Stephen, thank you so much. That was quite a window into the life of a monster. Thank you, sir. We are not done yet. Final thoughts. next. Revolution. It is good that you, an American, look fondly on the American Revolution because it was wonderful. Don't, however, fall in love with the concept of revolution itself. As we just talked about, it doesn't always work out that way. Yes, the existing thing is terrible. That does not in any way mean the next thing will be better. Keep that in mind as the mood in the country drifts more and more towards just burn everything down, civil war, things like that. These are not things we should cheer for. We should cheer for things righting themselves. I don't know that that can happen. I'm not even necessarily hopeful it will. But revolution? Scary stuff. All right, we'll do it again.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.